He showed me that in his notes, and he had crossed it out dutifully, worried about the clock. And he says, I said, what are you going to say about that? He says, it's the first instance of a tactical rappel ever recorded in history as they came down through the roof. And I'm like, what? That was not in my prison. I did not know that before tonight. All right, so here's what we're going to do to warm us up. It's been a day and a half since we talked about Ruth, and we've covered a lot of other ground since then. In pairs, you might have three of you, no fours, because four could be two sets of two, right? Do you see how I did that there? But in twos or threes, here's what I want you to do. I want the person whose birthday is closest to today to tell your partner what happened in Ruth chapter 1. You may need to peek at your notes. Don't try to cover all the things. Don't hold them accountable to hit all the fill-ins correctly. I'm a trained professional. But the first person whose birthday is closest to today, tell them what we talked about Friday night in Ruth chapter 1. You have 60 seconds. Ready, go. Okay, time's up. So Naomi and Elimelech are living where? What town? Bethlehem. What happens? Famine. So they decide to relocate just to survive. Where do they move to? Where's that? Across the Jordan River, over there by the Dead Sea, right. And so they settle there, and everything goes great in Moab, right? Because they're God's people. And bad things never happen to good people. Not so much. Ruth's husband, Elimelech, what happens to him? He dies, and that's sad, but you can still see the route ahead for provision for her, or Naomi's. I keep saying Ruth. I mean Naomi. Naomi's husband dies, but she's got two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and they both marry Moabite women, and so this is going to be good, and if you've got daughters-in-law, hopefully, you know, if things go well, you might have grandchildren, and everything's looking good. But what happens to her sons? They both die. So Ruth decides, I'm going home. She's heard that there's food back in Israel again. The harvest has come. Second person, explain what happens in chapter 2. Ready, go. So Naomi and her daughter-in-law Ruth are back living in Bethlehem. News spreads. Naomi's back. The gossip goes throughout the town. Can this be Naomi? What's happened to her? She looks terrible. And she shares her story. The Lord has been really, really rough in my life. She's suffering a crisis of faith. And how are these two women so vulnerable going to survive? And Ruth comes up with a plan. What does she come up with? I'm going to go glean in the field. And it just so happens. Whose field does she end up in?
Boaz.
And it just so happens that he's there checking on his workers. From the coincidence. It's just amazing, isn't it? And so Boaz asks about Ruth, and she's described consistently in this book as what? The Moabitess. Ruth from Moab. Ruth, an alien. Ruth, not one of us. Ruth, not from around here. It's like my father-in-law when he moved from New York to North Carolina. Can you imagine that move? And, you know, he was asked one time in a restaurant, "You want Greyuts?" G-R-E-E-Y-U-T-S is the phonetic spelling. Greyuts. Looks like grits, but they call it Greyuts where we live. And he's a very formal man. His name was Thomas Jefferson Foster. Guess who he was named after? And he goes, "I'm not sure what exactly of you speak, but let me try just one grit, please." And they're like, "You're not from around here, are you?" And indeed, he was not. And so all the customs of the day, this gleaning thing that was part of the Old Testament law, it was dual purpose. It was to provide for the poor, but it was also to prevent greed from those who had a lot and to remind them of the importance of generosity. And so this is great. And he not only lets her glean in the fields, he gives her extra, and she takes it back to Naomi. And Naomi's like, "Whose field were you working in today? This is not ordinary." "Oh, I believe his name was Boaz." And Naomi said, "Oh, he's what? He's a kinsman of ours. He's a kinsman of ours. He's a close relative of my husband who's passed away. This is just amazing. What a great man. This is his heart for both the living and the dead. This is amazing." And everything's great, but at the end of chapter 2, harvest time's over. And so now we pick up with chapter 3. I've entitled this session, Discovering Faith. Discovering Faith. Naomi's trust in God is coming back. Even though her grief continues, There's a stirring in her heart. She's being reminded of the greatness of God's character. As Boaz said to Ruth, "May the Lord give you shelter under His wings." And I'm sure she repeated that conversation to Naomi. And Naomi is once again thinking, maybe God has not forgotten me. But this gleaning is merely a short-term gig. When harvest is over, so's gleaning. How will we make it through the rest of the year? Verse 1 of chapter 3, "One day Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for?'" We would say, Naomi says, we need a long-term solution. This has been great that Boaz lets you glean in the field. He even provides a little extra around the corners. This is not a long-term solution. This is not a sustainable situation. "Don't you think I ought to try to find a new husband for you?" Notice she doesn't even pause there for a response. I've taught this one time with a group where there were a good number of Messianic Jews who were there. Jewish deep in culture, but yet having embraced Jesus Christ as the promised Messiah. And when I read that verse, there was laughter. And I thought, there's not supposed to be laughter there. Did I just mess up and say Ruth instead of Naomi again? What did I? And so I read the verse again. "One day Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well prepared for?'" And they laughed again. And I'm like, finally, I just go, time out. I like to use humor, but I normally like to know when I'm being funny. And I said, what is humorous about that? And they go, because every Jewish mother would say exactly that. And they said, you pause there. Why did you pause there? Because it's not really a question. It's a statement with a question mark at the end. She's not going to wait for Ruth to answer, and now she's going to tell her the plan. And I laughed out loud, and they go, you're Jewish now. Welcome to the family. Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a what? Kinsman, a relative, a close relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Again, questions with no answers. No pause. Naomi's got this thing figured out. Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. Naomi devises a plan to find Ruth a home and a husband. There's the two fill-ins, a home and a husband. I heard this preached one time. It's a pretty contemporary church. I like contemporary churches, though it is fun to have a few confirmed hymn sightings here every now and then. I must admit, I do miss a lot of the old hymns. They're so great in their teaching and their theology. But in this particular church, the song that they matched up with this was by the great saint of the church, Reba McEntire. I'm sure she and Fanny Crosby had lunch on a regular basis, I'm pretty sure. And they played the song Fancy. Now some of you are going, ha, 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 ha. And now you ought to feel guilty because I know that you know that song. And I will be judging you accordingly. In the song Fancy, it's about a mom. It's about a daughter. It's about poverty. It's about suffering. And the mom buys Fancy. Well, that's quite a name for a daughter, isn't it? Buys her a beautiful red dress and sends her off and says, Fancy, if you'll take care of the guys will take care of you. And kind of said, that's probably what inspired this song. Well, there may be slight parallels with that. That to me is borderline offensive. Maybe even across the border offensive. The writer has carefully given us insight into the high character of both Ruth and Boaz, has he not? And to see this as some sort of seduction scene is to miss the point of the story entirely. To draw that kind of parallel, in my mind, is borderline blasphemy. So if you just pulled it up on your cell phone, just go ahead and click delete, because we're not going to sing it to close the message tonight. Ruth says in verse 5, I will do whatever you say, Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law had told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he discovered a woman lying at his feet. I would imagine that would be somewhat surprising. Who are you? He asked. I am your servant Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a what? Really hot guy in spite of your age. Not what it says. You are a kinsman redeemer. It's a very spiritual act on her part. Ruth invites Boaz to fulfill his role as kinsman redeemer and marry her. This isn't a one-night stand. This isn't a seduction. This is saying, will you honor your commitment to your relative Elimelech? This is the same picture, by the way, and this is really important. This is part of the craftsmanship that went into the writing of this book, certainly under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. But the storyteller, if it's Samuel or whoever it was, gifted communicator, attention to detail that's so rich. This is the same picture, spread your garment over me, as when Boaz prayed that Ruth would be richly rewarded by the Lord of Israel, under whose wings Ruth had come to take refuge. Now it's the same picture. It's still a part of some Jewish weddings. It's still a part of Hindu marriage separations, that there's the covering of the bride with a cloth. It's the idea of provision and protection. You see, God is giving Boaz the opportunity to become the answer to his own prayer. May God extend his wings of protection over you, even though you're a Moabitess. Because God's wings are big enough for people of all people groups. And now God's noted that prayer, and at the invitation of Ruth, he has an opportunity to put his garment over her, as you know, he's the representative of God's blessing in her life. Boaz interprets Ruth's actions not as desperation, not as immorality, but as kindness. You sometimes hear this preached as if Boaz is, well, all right, it'll be a burden. She's not even from around here. If it's my duty according to the law, fine. I don't think that's how he viewed this. Look at the next verse. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness, hesed, loyal love, covenant-keeping love, displayed by a Moabitess, this attribute of God himself that you are modeling in the midst of a nation where everyone's doing what's right in his own eyes, how ironic that it's someone from Moab who's reminding us what God's character is really like. It's kind of like Jesus in the story of the Good Samaritan, isn't it? That's not the one in the story that you would have expected to show compassion, but that's exactly what happens. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. Now, my daughter, I will do for you all that you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of what? Yeah, so if you have any lingering thoughts of, but look how she approached him, and was that appropriate? And there was no misunderstanding of motive in his mind. It's like everybody in town has seen your character, and it's caused them to not view you as your identity based on your label. It's pretty amazing. Ruth's character has helped her overcome the prejudice of the townspeople. Verse 12, this is going so well, isn't it? In fact, it's going a little too well. You ever watch a TV show and you're like, maybe it's a crime show, and you know it's 48 hours or something, and you're like, this is great, this is a lead, this person's obviously guilty, this is the person who done it, and you glance at your watch and it's 25 minutes till the top of the hour, and you're like, there's too much time left in the episode, there's going to be a plot twist, this is all going too smoothly here. Well, that's the case here. Boaz says, although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. Ruh-roh. Stay here for the night. You see, there's a closer relative who's entitled to the first option to fulfill the role of kinsman redeemer. Like any great story, there's conflict in this book. There's tension. And it looked like it was going to be a 2.5 chapter book, and everyone lived happily ever after. But there's 4 chapters. And so don't cut the wedding cake quite yet. There's a nearer relative than I am. Oh no. A complication. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good. Let him redeem. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning. Boaz agrees to the plan, but presents a complication. another kinsman redeemer, closer relative. What's going to happen? What's the other person going to do? There's so much in this story that Naomi and Ruth cannot control. Again, we read this, especially if you've heard this taught before, if you've read it on your own, and it's like, yeah, it's just a momentary complication. Keep going. No, don't keep going. Because there's some time takes place here. There's some tension. There's some waiting that now must occur. So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. Why do you think she did that? She doesn't want to damage his reputation. And he says, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. Ruth and Boaz share a common concern for each other's reputation. At the end of the day, it's your reputation that counts, is it not? That's in business. I have a good friend. His name is Corb Hankey. Corb's retired now, but he was a really successful real estate developer in Atlanta. And he helped fund the launch of our church when we planted it. He's just a godly guy. He's got a wonderful, wonderful wife. He's probably closing in on 80 now. He may be over 80. I'm not sure. Corb told me about when he and his partner got ready to dissolve their partnership. His partner said, I've had some reversals. I need you to buy me out. Will you structure the deal? So Corb says, sure. And the guy's like, be fair. And Corb put it all together. And then at the end of it, the guy says, is this fair? And Corb says, I believe it is. And actually, I mistold the story. He had told Corb, I want to buy you out. That's what he had said. And Corb was like, okay, this is what it'll cost to buy me out. Then the man, when they finally came together, said, okay, I didn't tell you the truth. We've had some reversals. We've got some complications, family. Corb, I need you to buy me out. And he said, can we go with the same deal? And Corb goes, of course. And the man just smiled and he said, I should have known. You really did it fairly. You're just as content being on the other side of the deal as the deal you were thought you were on, even though Phil totally mistold the story and confused everyone in the room 10 years later. I said, how many pages were in that agreement? He goes, well, we had to do things decently and in order. I mean, you know, we called in the attorneys. He says, but it was settled that day with a handshake and a look in the eye. Hesed, loyal love, right? Covenant keeping. And that's what our marriage vows are. They're a covenant. That's what our commitment to our kids, when we say, hey, we'll go to the sweet shop tonight. Now, that's not exactly on the level of marriage vows or dissolving a company, but if you're 9 years old, you made a commitment. I told some of you about the first time I came to Maranatha. This was back in the day. This was pre-Gary. Gary has no responsibility for this. I was both the morning and the evening speaker. Remember when they used to do that here? Yeah, that's like cruel and unusual punishment, not only to the speakers, but to the listeners. You shouldn't have to hear one voice that many times in a 5 or 6 day period. The week was further complicated because there was some kind of, I still don't know details, the youth speaker went home after Monday night. There just wasn't a connection. And so I saw a bunch of kids coming into the adult session, and that's fine with me. I teach better when there's teenagers there. And somebody from the leadership said, yeah, we lost our youth speaker. And I go, that's all right. They're welcome. They seem to be plugged in. And he said, no. Will you do separate sessions for the teenagers? I'm not sure. I think I spoke 19 times that week. I know I was incredibly bored with myself. I also had our 9-year-old son with me that week, and I had shown him on the map where this is located. I said, we'll do some fishing. When are we going to fish? And so we're getting up at 5:30 in the morning because it's like, Philip was very good at reminding me, Dad, but you said, Dad, you promised. There was a bit of a gap between that visit to Maranatha and when I came back the second time. I'm glad somebody realized that killing the speaker is also killing the audience, and that's not good for anyone. And now speakers come here, and I think you get pick of better speakers because it's good for the speaker's family life also. That's a commercial. If the board met yesterday and is considering going back to one speaker, there, we just nuked that off the agenda. Please don't do that. Boaz also says, before they parted, Ruth, bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and he put it on her. Probably tied it around her back like a backpack, possibly in the front. Then he went into town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi, Naomi asked, how did it go, my daughter? And I think that probably was pretty close to her tone. I don't think Naomi had to search around the house, or that Ruth had to search around the house for Naomi. Are you here? I think Naomi is looking out the front window. Probably met her at the front door. How did it go, my daughter? Then she told her everything that Boaz had done for her. There's an important detail here. Boaz has signaled his desire to provide not just for Ruth, but for Naomi too, the widow of their common relative, Elimelech. I've seen some pretty cool weddings recently where it's a blended family. And that can be caused either through death, that can be caused by divorce. And I've seen some pretty cool weddings where, sure, the guy is just marrying the woman, period. That's a covenant. But if there's a young daughter or a young son, in some of these weddings, there's a minute where the new groom speaks to the son or daughter also. I'm not going to replace your daddy. Your daddy was unique and he was special. But I promise to love you. And I promise to be here for you. And I want to be as close as you want to be to each other. And I've even seen a few ceremonies, especially where there's a young girl, where the groom actually gives a little ring, not a wedding ring, not an engagement ring, but a ring of commitment to a young girl. Here it's the opposite way. The marriage is to the daughter, but the commitment is also to her mother-in-law. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. We're only in this country, by the way, beginning to figure out what to do with blended families. It's a big thing. It's a significant percentage of all weddings now involve blended families. And I don't know if you're doing anything here with Maranatha to address that or not when you have marriage things, but it's a need. And if you address that need, you will pack this place out because there's not enough Christian teaching related to how to handle that. It's easy to... Where are we? I've already turned that page. Don't want to skip that. Ruth added, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Then Naomi said, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens. For the man will not rest until the matter is settled. Paraphrase that, Naomi says, I know Boaz. Boaz didn't get where he is in terms of business and status in our community by letting grass grow under his feet. That's a really loose paraphrase. I know Boaz. He's not going to wait long to finalize this matter. After Ruth has done all she could, Naomi tells her to wait. Ruth is not a waiting type of person. Have you noticed that? I'm going back with you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I'm going to die. I'm going. But honey, you're young. Remarry. Stay here with your own people. Naomi, please don't argue with me. I'm going. Okay? End of discussion. She's the one who says, Naomi, let me go glean and get some grain for us to eat. She doesn't sit back and go, Naomi, you know the drill. You know the stuff in the law. And I mean, people are still feeling sorry for you because you lost your husband. Why don't you go glean out in the field? Ruth says, no, I'll solve this problem. Ruth is an initiator. Do you know what? Initiating and waiting are both expressions of faith. Most people in this room tend to lean one way or the other. There are men and women in this room who, you're the starters. You like to make stuff happen. In fact, you're even best in a crisis. We used to joke about Bruce Wilkinson, who founded Walk Through the Bible. He was at his best in a crisis. I worked for a guy at Walk Through. He was a retired Navy captain. He was born on D-Day. He was marked for greatness. He had a great naval career. He was up for admiral when he left the Navy and came to work for Walk Through the Bible. This guy was amazing. He was great in a crisis. And we used to joke about both Jim Kenney and Bruce Wilkinson. It's like, they're best in a crisis. And you know what? If there's not a crisis, they will create one. So there's something to do that will leverage their strengths. Some of you are like that. Raise your hand if you tend to be an initiator. Raise your hand. I want to see this. Okay. How many of you would say, yep, I'm married to that, and I'm more a responder, I'm more a person who likes to wait. I want to see what God can do before I jump in. I'm not like Simon Peter jumping out of the boat. I'm there going, I'll hold the nets, go Simon, go. You're more of a responder, a waiting person. And then there's the other 48.2% that didn't vote either way because you're afraid I'll have you up here lying on a blanket or something if you volunteer. I get this. Will you please realize that both of those can be an expression of faith? It's easy, especially in a marriage situation. God rarely brings two people wired just the same together. And that can be a cause of a lot of tension and conflict there. But both can be expressions of faith. It's important to initiate. I mean, if you're interested in finding a job, it's okay to put together a resume. That's not defying God's will. That's not doing it on your own. That's good business practice. It's okay to pass it out. It's okay to get it online. That's not usurping God's leadership. I have a friend, I won't tell you his name. He's 63, he is never married, which that's perfectly fine. I mean, he's not a half a person walking around going, who will complete me, okay? Except in his case, he very much wants to get married. We've had many conversations. Ellen, how did you and Phil know that you were right for each other? Talk through, and he'll take notes when we're doing this. And then we'll ask him, we'll say, have you met anybody yet? And we'll say, well, possibly. We'll say, well, have you been on a date? No. Well, have you had a conversation with her? Well, no. Well, when are you going to have a conversation with somebody? Because you can take all the notes in the world, and that's not going to get us anywhere. This is his statement. When I meet the woman that I'm supposed to marry, then I'll talk to her. Initiating can be an expression of faith. It's not cutting God out of the equation. Choosing a treatment plan for your cancer or other illness. If you've gotten five opinions, there's going to come a point in time when you have to say, okay, this is the doctor I'm going to choose to trust, and this is the treatment plan we're going to go. And don't hang out too long at a place like Maranatha because you'll find out there's actually nine opinions of what you could do to fix that. But waiting is also part of it. There's a time just to wait. And it's not you've done all you can and now it's time to trust God. It's trusting God in the midst of the initiating, but still you get to this point, there's nothing else Ruth and Naomi could do. And Naomi wisely says, wait, my daughter. The good news is, with a guy like Boaz, I don't think you'll have to wait long. I'll bet by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, in session 4, he'll have the matter resolved. I know this guy. You're not going to have to wait long. The balance of those two. Will you please figure out what it is and write a book about it, and I will buy the first 10 copies. Because oftentimes I don't know where that balance is. When we're raising funds for Walk Through the Bible, we need to raise about $3 million a year to sustain our work around the world. And I do know that if I just sit in my office and pray and never go out and have any conversations with people and don't present the need, that doesn't work very well. But I also have learned, because I've been president now 12 years, that if I'm like, I got to solve this. The future of Christendom depends on me. We're in 130 countries. I got to go do this. I've got to go do this. And if I try to do that in the flesh, then I can have 3 meetings a day and we don't see the results that we need. And that's why God says things like, you know what, in the multitude of counselors, there's great wisdom. Because the truth of the matter is none of us are balanced. I've used this quote here before, but my mentor, Dr. Howard Hendricks, used to say, no one is balanced. Anyone you see who appears to be balanced is merely passing through the midpoint on their way from one extreme to the other. Remember when you learned to drive? When I was teaching Emily to drive, she started watching me. She goes, why does the car go straight for you, but it doesn't go straight for me? I go, that's not true. It doesn't go straight for me either. She goes, no, when I drive, it goes that way, and then I have to bring it back that way. What's the answer? I'm making a lot more frequent, small adjustments, because that's what comes with age. And that's what comes with wisdom. And that's what comes from having friends in your small group, your neighbors at Maranatha, the people in your Sunday school class back home. I'm going to let you initiate tonight. Fight for the line at the sweet shop like you're the third monkey in line. Right behind Ryan and me. But you are going to have to wait. You are going to have to wait until 10 o'clock tomorrow. But if I know Boaz, he's not going to let us get in the car and head for home without resolving this matter. Father, forgive us when we use our personality as an excuse, when we're so passive and we dump it all on you. Lord, it is all on you. You're the one who carries the weight and burden, but you've chosen to get things done through people. And so, Father, may we be bold in sharing Christ with our loved ones. May we be generous in our giving. May we take action. May we be problem solvers. May we be willing to initiate, even if that's not native to our personality. But Father, there are also times when you slow us down. And very often, you don't operate according to our schedule because of the fact that you're eternal. You are never in a hurry, and oftentimes I am. So Lord, teach us to wait also. Because during that delay, that does not mean that you are idle. It means that you're working behind the curtain in ways that we don't even see, and sometimes you don't even reveal it to us in this life, but in heaven someday, a whole lot more things will make sense. So nudge us by your Spirit when it's time to initiate. And by that same Holy Spirit, put a hand in front of us to slow us down when we need to just wait and give you space to work on our behalf. Lord, thank you that simultaneously you are bringing Ruth to know you and to put her faith in you, and you are simultaneously restoring to Naomi the joy of her salvation. Lord, you are the ultimate multitasker. And now to think that you're using this story thousands of years later to do those exact same things in our lives, we marvel at your sovereignty and your wisdom and your love. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.